Listen to past shows on demand at SiriusXM.com and on the SiriusXM app. Now, back to Forward Thinking Radio, live on SiriusXM Progress 127.
Hey, welcome back. Jonathan Aberman, Forward Thinking Radio. You know, before I forget, if you haven't downloaded the app for your phone, your Android phone, or your iPhone, I highly recommend it. I use it all the time. It's really, really, not just to listen to me, by the way. I'm not going to lie to you. Every now and then I do get a chance to check out Forward Thinking Radio in my car, maybe like you're doing now. But I highly recommend the app. You should definitely check it out. It's terrific. I use it an awful lot. You can tailor your music and tailor it to listen to. Speaking of tailoring what you're listening to, I'm going to tailor what you're listening to now, which is Stan Soloway. Stan is president and CEO of Solera Strategies. He has been involved in innovation, national security, and policy, which is something that we care an awful lot about because, frankly, we want our money to go as far as possible. We want the government to work well. And Stan has been the forefront of that for many years, trying to help make sense of it all. Stan Soloway, thanks for joining me. Forward Thinking Radio this evening.
Great to be with you, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Let's start with this. Stan, last week you wrote an article here in D.C. that got a fair bit of interest where you talked about and analyzed the current situation with this two-year budget deal and expressed some concern that it might not hold up. Let's start there. Would you share with the listeners what you were getting at in the article and how you look at the current political calculus and why you might be concerned about what's going on downtown?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons to be concerned with what's going on in Washington. I think we write books about it. But with regard to the budget, you remember last year they signed what was supposedly a two-year deal. And the whole idea was to avoid any sort of budget fights and threats of shutdowns and so forth until after the elections, get through the elections this November. Yeah. It wasn't really a two-year deal. It was really kind of a year, but people called it a two-year deal. But I think the alarm bells that are starting to go off right now, and it's not just me, there are some others who are starting to get concerned about this, is if you look at the tenor of the current primaries and recognize that if you look on the Republican side, almost 80% of the votes, 70-some-odd percent of the votes, have gone to the two sort of absolutist hell-no candidates. And on the Democratic side, not an insignificant percentage of votes have obviously gone to Bernie Sanders, who in the realm of federal spending you might qualify as a hell-yes candidate. So that raises a question of what happens when all the members of Congress who have not yet had their primaries go home and have to run for re-election in their primaries. As a lot of people have documented, the biggest threat to members of Congress is really in their primaries. And if we've seen in some Republican primaries over the last year, some pretty shaky holds on seats and some really big upsets. So you have Senator Shelby from Alabama who openly said that he had to change his position on something because he had a challenge from his right. John Boehner, the former Speaker, his seat was the primary for his seat. That's one of the few states that's actually had their congressional primaries. Went to a Tea Party member. Mm-hmm. So if, in fact, that is the mood of the electorate that is coming out to vote, and these members of Congress have to go back home and face that electorate, some of them not even until September for their primaries, you have to get concerned about what message they're going to come back with in terms of protecting themselves through the election process and what commitments they're going to have to make. And you know, there's already been a group of conservative Republicans who said they're no longer feeling beholden to the deal that was cut. And so I think we're headed into a pretty dicey period of time trying to even get the government funded at all.
Mm-hmm. And I want to give you props and want everybody to remember that you were one of the first people here in D.C. to call that we may have another shutdown.
Yeah, so. I don't like to be a Chicken Little here. I mean, I was one of the last ones to believe there was going to be a shutdown last time. And I could well be and hope I'm way wrong this time. I am concerned that the way the trend we're on right now, and if you think about a lot of the language coming out of particularly the Cruz and Trump campaigns about government and about bureaucrats, that the voters who are supporting those folks may not actually be too upset if government shuts down because they don't really understand the role government plays. So I think it's something to be concerned about, keep our eyes on.
I agree. Now, let's shift gears a bit. You've been involved in innovation and government for many, many years now, breaking down the walls, as it were, first policy in government and now with helping various small companies. With respect to our listeners, why is it so hard for government to reform? Why is it so hard for government to change the way it deals with spending our money?
Well, again, another huge question and something that's befuddled you, me, and so many others, scores of other people for a long time. I think a lot of it comes down to just the fact that the government, unlike any other institution, or more so than any other institution, is governed by politics. That's an obvious statement, but we sometimes don't think about how that affects the way government's managed. It is also a culture where, particularly over the last 15 years, you can't really experiment with impunity. If things go wrong, even a really honest, good attempt to try something, there's inevitably somebody who wants to beat you up for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
So we've created a culture in which people are afraid to do anything. And I think also, I could go through a whole long laundry list, but I think another big factor is we have, within government and to a certain extent in parts of industry, built up an entire infrastructure to support the world as it was or as it, at the time, not as it is today or will be in the future. And trying to get those folks to let go is really brutally difficult.
We're here with Stan Soloway. He's president and CEO of Solera Strategies. The world you're talking about is the world of the Cold War and the space race and big government programs?
Well, I think so there's two things. If you take it from a technology perspective, I think if you think of the Cold War and the space race and what that those two things, if they can define them as things, or momentous historical eras, actually brought in terms of launching the technology revolution, it's pretty obvious. But what that also did is it also, since the early 70s, mid-70s, began to change the ownership of technology. So since the mid-70s, the private sector has spent far more money in R&D than the government, which never had happened before that. And consequently, a lot of the great technology breakthroughs, technology changes, advances, and so forth, are all taking place now largely in the private sector, not in or under the auspice of government. So that's one piece that has enormous ramifications for workforce, for access to technology, and so forth. The other side is that we built up, and it's largely, the government system is largely built around the defense system.
Mm-hmm.
And a closed sort of monopsony market where there's really one buyer. That market has dramatically changed. It's become much less competitive. There's only a handful of, relative to what it used to be, a handful of major players. But the reality is that the technology that is going into new systems, from major weapon systems all the way through anything you think about, from a homeland, national security, and business processes, are largely being generated in the commercial world. And a lot of the companies that are in and around government today are constantly trying to introduce new ideas and new thinking, and they're finding the same barriers that folks on the outside face, which is, well, that's not the way we're structured. We don't have the infrastructure for it. We don't necessarily understand it. We don't have the workforce for it, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a whole combination of forces that just make that kind of getting change to take hold really, really brutally difficult.
And there's another issue here as well, which is that for a long while, people were very concerned about executive prerogative and the idea that the executive branch shouldn't be able to give benefits to their friends, the whole idea of patronage. And so a lot of the rules that you spend your day working through with your clients and as a policymaker, I mean, those rules make it hard, but they were put in place for a well-meaning reason, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, all of the regulations around, particularly in federal acquisition, which is how the government accesses the private sector, all of those rules, by and large, were set up to make sure the government had some control, had transparency, accountability, and to protect its best the best interests of the taxpayer. The problem is that the rules have grown unbelievably voluminous, and the overkill has been tremendous. Second, the rules have not kept up with the fact that the real game is no longer in this closed government world, but in a much broader environment where you want to be able to access new capabilities and open your aperture, whether you're the government or a lot of government contractors today are trying to open that aperture but struggling themselves to bring new players in. So whatever anything goes wrong, we just throw another rule on. We throw another layer of rule, another level of compliance, and it makes it brutally difficult. So when I deal with companies in Silicon Valley and elsewhere around the country who have capabilities that very clearly have a relevance to government, could have actually huge, huge impacts. Part of the resistance is the system is so different than anything we face in the commercial world. It's too hard. And frankly, for many of them, the government's just not that important a customer.
Let me make one point. I'll just
encapsulate it all in one thing. 2 weeks ago, the Air Force announced that they have contracted to use IBM's Watson, cognitive computing capability, to support acquisition. And they first look at that and go, what a great idea, because the ability to take massive amounts of data, information about technologies, market trends, all that kind of stuff you could put together and really help define a strategy for approaching different acquisition challenges the government has, and some of them are very complex. It sounded great. But the example the Air Force used to explain how they were going to use Watson was to help their contracting officers decipher the federal rules. Well, if the federal rules are so complicated that I need cognitive computing, maybe there's something wrong with the rules.
I would say so. We're here with Stan Soloway, President and CEO of Solera Strategies, an expert on national security and change and innovation. Stan, that's deliciously ironic, but I'll push on. And if I'm concerned as I am, and you are, and many of our listeners are as well, this sounds to me like a situation where there may is there too much regulation, or is it that the regulation is just, it's like a wedding cake that's got too many layers, and somebody just needs to get in and actually look at how this case constructed and bake a new one? Or I mean, how would you categorize this from a policy standpoint for voters and people who care about this stuff?
I think it's we way overregulated, but not in the traditional sense where you have an argument whether we should or should not have regulations on X, Y, or Z. I think the overregulation is that it's so heavily government unique and not consistent with how we regulate the economy or the marketplace at large. If we could align those two, I don't have a problem with regulation. I think when you're dealing with public dollars, you want to make sure you can assure the public that you're doing the best job you can to protect their equities. But when you build up this mammoth regime of government-unique compliance requirements, unique auditing requirements that have absolutely no bearing or relationship to what we use in generally accepted cost accounting, special things, certifications that you'd never find anywhere in the commercial world, all of those things, those are government-unique regulations for the government-unique for the government marketplace that become highly unnecessary and non-value-added. What we need to do is have a regulatory regime that ensures the public interest, but is much more aligned with the way we regulate and manage in the marketplace generally, so that we can have much more broad access, whether it's companies coming direct into the government or working with current government contractors as partners, or current government contractors actually being able to reach back into their commercial sides of their businesses, which many of them have, and actually bring all that to bear.
So if I'm an entrepreneur, this doesn't sound particularly compelling to me, but yet you work with entrepreneurs all the time. So how and why would an entrepreneur be able to find their way through this morass?
Well, you have to want to do it. I mean, so the first thing is it a market that's interesting? And so let me give you two examples. I have a company that had long talks with a very, very large company in the tech space. It does no government business. And they basically said, no, not interested. And they've just decided they're not going to pursue it. But there are a number of entrepreneurs and startups and others who have capabilities that could find a home in government. And you have to have a little bit of stick-to-itiveness. And there are ways, and I mean perfectly legitimate, I don't mean to suggest you get around the rules, but there are ways in which commercial capabilities can come into the market and do it in a way that is both value-added for the company and value-added for the government. It's not easy, and you have to understand what you're getting into. What it is not is a market that you can dip your toes into. Mm-hmm. You got to dive in. And so for some firms, particularly those who are in the sort of that startup world where you have to be generating revenue quickly and growing quickly, this is actually not the easiest place to do that. But if you make a commitment to it, there are ways to do it with A, outbreaking your back or your bank, and B, it could be a good market to be in. You can really make a difference and actually do well by doing good.
And I'm in favor of that. I'm in favor of doing well by doing good, and I'm also in favor of seeing some reform and some innovation coming in. And it sounds to me, Stan Soloway, you are at the crucible of helping us make that happen, so we appreciate that.
My pleasure.
It's great having you on the show. Forward
great
to your radio.
To you, great. Thanks, Jonathan.
Stan Soloway, President and CEO of Solera Strategies, talking about innovation and federal government. Yes, it can happen. Something that we hope never happens is a dirty bomb attack. We're going to talk about the implications of that. There's some scary things that came out of an investigation of what went on in Brussels last month. We'll be joined by Patrick Malone. He is national security reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Very, very important conversation. We're going to have it with him live in the studio right after the break. Stay tuned.